Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We have a lot to share today. Of course, we're going to begin with the latest on health and healing. A study from the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke shows how study, in the way that they're doing it, means you should take short breaks, and that can help our brains learn new skills. I'll go into depth on that. We have a lot of things to talk about on living a longer and healthier life, always from peer-reviewed literature. But then more importantly today, we're going to take on two issues in depth. You will hear from Israel later in the program, one of our guests, and that guest is going to be talking about the New York Times. He is probably the world's leading authority upon the nefarious history of disinformation, of out-and-out lies, and of hidden agendas throughout the decades of the New York Times. I intend to probe him on issues that go to the very heart of what the New York Times is doing today. For example, they support 5G, not just support it mildly. They're major advocates of it. They never published anything that challenges the assumption that 5G is safe. They have no proof on their side whatsoever, nor did any of the people testifying under oath before a Senate committee that 5G had been studied for its safety. You would just be amazed to watch all these heads of the communication industry companies say, we haven't done studies. Well, if you haven't done studies, why in the world are you promoting 5G, the internet of all things? The New York Times are responsible for that as well. How they lied us into a major war in Iraq and all the consequences, and who was held accountable or who was not. Now they're suppressing everything about natural or non-toxic treatments, including major medicines, but only promoting vaccines. They've been wrong about every single thing on COVID. How could that many brilliant people be that wrong consistently? There's a pattern of wrongness, and yet people continue to pay attention to them. Maybe our guests will share enough insight that you'll begin to question them as a resource. Also today, you're going to hear from a gentleman you have not heard or seen at any point. He is one of the most intelligent scientists on the planet. He is a Dr. Fleming. Dr. Fleming is a board-certified cardiologist. He is also a PhD in physics. He is also has a doctorate of jurisprudence as a lawyer. He is a research scientist. He's published in the peer-reviewed literature. In fact, they did a whole special on him because he was the first physician in 1984 to show that most heart disease was due to inflammation. And that was a whole new study. So a lot of people can say that they're alive today because of his work on the heart. So why are you going to be hearing from him today? Simple. Because he is going to show you virtually all the deception surrounding COVID vaccines. Whether you vaccinate or not is your business. I am pro-vaccine, but I have a caveat. Show me the evidence that your vaccine has been tested properly over a period of time in a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study where saline, a salt solution, is the placebo. And show me where you've included all the people that later would be expected to take the vaccine, meaning cancer patients, pregnant women, children, babies, senior citizens with compromised immune systems. Include those people in a study. If you do not include them, and they never do, but then you insist afterwards that they must take them, you make them mandatory, then you've engaged in fraudulent science and crimes against humanity. That's exactly what's happening. But you're not allowed to say anything critical. You're not allowed to make a judgment against anything COVID or Anthony Fauci. But we have. We have been the leading radio program in the world challenging COVID and what's wrong with it and what you could do to save your life. He will continue that today. You will not hear this interview anywhere else. Please share this. That's our program. I'll deal with some other issues as well, including environmental issues. But we always want to begin by something that can help people live a longer life. And we're going to start with broccoli. Now, in broccoli sprouts, which you could grow, by the way, in about a week on your own kitchen countertop, you have a chemical called sulforaphane, S-U-L-F-O-R-A-P-H-A-N-E. It improves your glucose levels. That means if you're a diabetic, if you are pre-diabetic, and there are about 100 million Americans, more or less, who are pre-diabetic or diabetic, that could keep your blood sugar more even. That could help protect your eyes, your heart, your brain, and your pancreas. This is from the University of Gothenburg, which is in Sweden. So this is a very important antioxidant, and it's richly occurring in broccoli. And that means it's a new anti-diabetic nutrient. And this was a patient study showing significant lowering blood sugar levels in participants who ate broccoli extract with high levels of sulforaphane. Quote, there are strong indications that this can become a valuable supplement to existing medications. This was published in Translational Medicine, a major peer-reviewed journal. So along with exercise, along with a healthy plant-based diet, along with lots of nuts and seeds and legumes and tubers, starchy and leafy vegetables, fruits and smoothies, you can absolutely control your blood sugar. I've done two clinical studies on diabetes, and at the end of this study, one was 3 months, one was 6 months, people who had been diabetic and taking medication for at least 3 years prior to the study to get in, 97% were free of all medications with normal blood sugars at the end of these studies to prevent diabetes, because what will help a patient that is natural, non-toxic, lower the incidence of disease can also be used to prevent it. You would never use chemotherapy to prevent cancer, and you wouldn't use, for example, you wouldn't use Paxil to prevent depression, but using natural things, you could do that. So something to think about, because we don't want to have elevated blood sugar levels. That's not good. Also, from the University of Chile, which is in Chile, they found beneficial effects of supplementing with oat beta glucan. Oat is in oats, O-A-T, beta, B-E-T-A, glucan, G-L-U-C-A-N. They use it for 3 months each day. They, too, were using it on type 2 diabetes. Quote, there is a growing interest in the use of functional foods. By the way, a functional food is something that functions in a positive way in your body. Studies indicate the contribution of beta-glucans to glycemic control. That means your blood sugar. But few have evaluated intricately the effect of this soluble dietary fiber on appetite-regulating hormones, microbiota. But they did here, and they found that it made enormous difference. So one more thing to add, if you are diabetic or pre-diabetic, oat beta-glucan. Easy to get, inexpensive, and can help that. Also from the University of Colorado, air pollution exposure during pregnancy can boost babies' obesity risk, meaning that women exposed to higher levels of air pollution during pregnancy have babies who grow unusually fast in the first months after birth, putting on excess fat that puts them at risk of obesity and related diseases later in life. This was published in the Journal of Environmental Health. Simple things that you just don't, most people don't think about the quality of the air, and especially when, you know, they're pregnant, they're active, not realizing that we should all be having some form of air filtration system in our homes. Now, if you can't afford an air filtration system, at least one that gets rid of all the heavy particulate matter from lead, cadmium, mercury, aluminum in the air, then load up your house with plants. Plants absorb toxins and give off oxygen. So that's a good exchange. So we must pay attention to this. Also, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, a National Institute of Health scientist discovered that the resting brain repeatedly replays compressed memories of what was just practiced. What do I mean by this? In a study of healthy volunteers, the National Institute of Health researchers have mapped out the brain activity that flows when we learn a new skill, let's say playing a new song on a piano, and discovered why taking short breaks from practice is a key to learning. The researchers found that during the rest, the volunteers' brains rapidly and repeatedly replayed faster versions of the activity seen while they practiced typing a code. The more volunteer replayed the activity, the better they performed during subsequent practice sessions, suggesting rest strengthened memories. Now, for those of you who were just attended the anti-aging, the fourth anti-aging study a month ago when it ended on campus, one of the things I highlighted was that you would read only 2 pages of a book. You would listen to only 15 minutes of meditation music. You would only watch a self-empowerment video like Overcoming the Dark Side or Love for 15 minutes. And then, in a quiet time, replay the memory of that and then allow that memory through conscious awareness and mindful meditation to think, what is the deeper meaning of what I've just read? Otherwise, you'll start reading and keep reading, even if it's all good material, and then that would be like watching Dr. Zhivago, Citizen Kane, what would be another really good film? Oh, The Maltese Falcon, that was a fun one. And watch all of them one after another. A, you won't remember anything about any of them, and none of it will have an impact. So I believe that we should do everything in shorter segments and then think about what it is we're trying to learn. What lessons hidden in here? Let's go on an emotional archaeological dig. Let's try to find the truth that can liberate fear, anxiety, depression, insecurity, uncertainty by focusing upon what the real message is. And by the way, you could do the same thing when you're watching the news and decide, is this reasonable? Because something that I learned from my parents, who were not college educated, but had an abundance of common sense and good reason, is that if something doesn't seem right and you feel it in your gut, your intuition is telling you, this isn't right, trust that. But we've learned not to trust our intuition, and we've learned not to trust our reason. Instead, we only trust the experts or the publications that are considered forms for expert opinion. So we trust Google and Facebook and Twitter and Wikipedia. None should be trusted. They've all betrayed us. We trust the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN. None should be trusted, left or right. They've all betrayed us. Now even textbooks, with the new D'Angelo's concept, the modern version of racism that is trying to be legitimized in white fragility, you shouldn't trust this stuff. The fact that a so-called expert like Anthony Fauci or Robert Gallo told you what the real truth about AIDS, they were wrong. And they're still wrong. They're wrong now. He's wrong today about COVID. So learn to take a break from being propagandized and seek the truth for yourself. So anyhow, another one that comes up is the National Institutes of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. They did a study, and also they found that stroke victims in particular, and I was just working with one very successfully so, take short bursts of energy, meaning put your energy into something, really focus on something, and then take a break. Take a break, and then try to reprocess that in your mind. Also from a major university, Pankel in Turkey, extracts from cinnamon and pomegranate have very strong antimicrobial activities against food poisoning bacteria. So that's good. It means that when you're taking cinnamon, you're helping to inhibit the growth of two common food pathogens, E. coli and Staphylococcus aureus. That can help. Put it in your smoothies. Cinnamon and pomegranate, both terrific. Also, pomegranate concentrate does the same, and eating pomegranates. In fact, films containing cinnamon pomegranate compounds, which are far less powerful than the actual cinnamon, and there's a lot of different cinnamons, but Jamaican cinnamon is particularly good, but pomegranate, and it was able to prevent food spoilage. Important. And so that's the latest on health and healing. We're 15 minutes in our program, and we're going to take a break. Now, when we come back from the break, we're going to go to this really unique, mind you, this is a unique doctor. He's pro-vaccine. He's pro-orthodox medicine. He is a major heavyweight, top of the food chain, orthodox medical doctor who has contributed enormous health and well-being benefits to better understanding the heart. He is on medical boards. He's on scientific boards. He's on review boards. And he's a PhD scientist on top of that. So, again, I've only selected every day this week, every day, I've only selected the best of the best of orthodoxy to challenge the worst of the worst of orthodoxy. So these are people challenging the New York Times, Anthony Fauci, and all the other dancing clowns in our medical establishment who've compromised for on principles that they should not have. Back in a moment with what he has to say. You have not heard this. This is exclusive to you.
Well, there's actually two things that kind of get run together when we talk about this virus. One is the virus itself, which is SARS-CoV-2. And the other is the consequence of people who don't do well when they get the virus, and that's what we call COVID or coronavirus disease. And it's important to kind of distinguish the two. To begin with, SARS-CoV-2, if you look at the origins of it, or at least the data that is pointing to the origins of it, does not appear to be anything that is naturally occurring. There is something called gain-of-function research that some people have heard of, and gain-of-function is exactly what it sounds like. It's the ability to increase the characteristics of a virus, in this case, to infect people and subsequently make them ill. That's called gain-of-function. For the people who don't think that that exists, there was actually a moratorium placed on gain-of-function research in about 2014, 2015, due to concerns that scientists like myself had over the consequences of what was happening. It had already been shown that gain of function could increase the infectivity of SARS. Both Ralph Barrick at the University of North Carolina and Xi Xing Li at the Wuhan Virology Institute in Wuhan have published papers and done documentaries where they've admitted that they have made the viruses in the lab, and they've taken backbones of one virus and inserted spike proteins of other viruses to increase the infectivity of the viruses that they were making in the lab. So there are several inserts that exist. One is the HIV glycoprotein 120 insert, which adds HIV characteristics to the virus. There is another one called PRRA, which is a proline, alanine, arginine insert that increases the infectivity any place that there's something called a purine cleavage site, which is primarily in the brain, making this extremely infectious for the brain, although not a lot of people have been talking about that. It's a very critical component. And then the spike protein itself also has something that is a prion-like region, which is prions are abnormally folded proteins. And so when they come into contact with other proteins, they can alter the shape of those proteins. And that, as you may reflect back, is what you would refer to as mad cow disease. That was a classic example of a prion passed on process through cows. So what we're looking at is something that has been gain of function made. Now, it's interesting to note that the U.S. government has provided much of the money for that gain of function. In fact, NIH, NIAID, the FDA, Department of Defense, Commerce Department, several of our agencies have funneled gain of function research through many of the universities and a gentleman by the name of Peter Daszak at EcoHealth. Now, Peter Daszak at EcoHealth has admitted that he has had Ralph Baric at the University of North Carolina work on these viruses. And Ralph Baric has admitted that he and Cheng Li have modified viruses, changed them, genetically engineered them, and in about 2015, they started publishing some significant papers on that. By 2017, they were very clearly stating that not only could they do this almost at will, but they were able to create much more virulent or nasty viruses with the potential of creating a pandemic. By the middle of 2019, before anybody even heard of COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 in this country or throughout the world, the Wuhan Institute actually wiped its computers of much of the data on these viruses. Now, the problem here is that since money was funneled to Peter Daszak at EcoHealth, and he's admitted to paying for Ralph Baric and Xizheng Li to work on these projects, it's you know, the best expression is the fox guarding the chicken coop, which is at Ralph Peter Daszak is actually the head of the WHO committee looking at the Wuhan Institute right now. So you've got the guy who is getting massive amounts of money paying for gain of function research, now checking to see if any gain of function research occurred. And it's not likely he's going to confess up and say there was, because that's going to cut off his funding. In fact, even though there was a brief moratorium for several years on gain of function, President Trump attempted to block research monies getting to Peter Daszak earlier in 2020, and that block seemed to last for about 3 months. I'm not sure how or who got around that blockade, but it eventually more money got funneled to Peter Daszak. So you have a non-naturally occurring virus. In fact, an important thing to realize is that that PRRA insert that we were talking about is not found in any other coronavirus on the planet. It is found in HIV. It is found in rabies virus. It is found in cobra toxin, but it's not found in any other coronavirus. And when people ask about mutations, you know, these things occur one base pair at a time. The PRRA insert would be 12 base pairs to accomplish that. So we're not talking about something that logistically has a probability of happening naturally. And there's data that Daszak has and Ralph Daszak has talked about with others, where they forced the initial changes in these viruses using ferrets to try to force a change in mutation that occurred. That was back in the 2015 to 2017 range. So we have a nice linear track record with documents and research monies out of the US government going to these people for gain of function research. Nobody's denying it happens. Ralph Baric has admitted that there would be no way in the world that you would know that this gain of function research was happening, because if they didn't want you to know, they simply wouldn't leave their university signatures on it, and you would be none the wiser, and it would make it look like it was naturally occurring. So we have a virus that I would argue is 99% data there that is completely man-made. And when you realize that, then you have to start raising serious questions about the vaccines, because the vaccines are nothing but the mRNA code of this virus. And if this virus is man-made, we've now done, for the first time ever in the history of mankind, put a genetic code in produced by man or women, you know. Because Cheng Li was clearly involved with this, so I guess mankind now applies to men and women. I don't know. It's confusing some days. You know, we now have a vaccine that carries the genetic code of something that has all the fingerprints, all the blood marks of a man-made gain of function process. And the vaccine itself is an additional gain of function, because these viruses or viruses naturally have to get into the cells somehow. ACE2 receptors is what you've all heard of, although it's actually a combination of a few things. It's the ACE receptor next to the furin, F-U-R-I-N, cleavage site, which recognizes that PRRA, and something called transmembrane protein series 2, or TMPRSS2, all three together. And so this virus could not have been put together better to infect cells. And most people, I think, are aware of the consequences with people dying with inflammation and blood clotting, which is what my theory proposed in 94, proposed it again in 95 at American Heart, published it in a cardiology textbook in 99. We did research work on the bacteria in 2000 to 2003, and then, as you mentioned, it was on 2020 and 2004, all showing that the consequences of why these viruses can kill people is that they produce inflammation and blood clotting. Typically, what we have seen are two groups of people: the very immune naive, which could be extremely young people with immune problems, or people with immune deficiency syndromes, or diabetics, or the group of people whose immune system is also out of whack because it's hyperinflammatory, and those are the people with all the comorbidities we've been talking about, the very advanced in age, people with heart disease, strokes, high blood pressure, diabetes, cancer, all the reasons why people die. And in this country, in the U.S., there hasn't been a lot of data collected on the cause of death of people. But in Hamburg, Germany, and other places, they've done autopsies on these people, and they find massive blood clots in the heart and the lungs. We now know that influenza can cause the same phenomenon, and estimates are now that influenza A actually is responsible, that about 12% of the deaths with influenza A are the result of blood clots happening in the heart, causing massive heart attacks and killing people. So when these people are dying, it's because their immune system is off. Now, my most recent concern, looking at the VAERS numbers, the vaccine adverse events site that the CDC has up on it, is showing a massive number of adverse events in individuals in that middle age room, the 20, 30, 40, and 50 age. And my concern about that is because this vaccine is able to put a massive amount of mRNA into the cells, that people with a normal immune system are now being overwhelmed and they're gearing up a hyperinflammatory response by virtue of just how much there is. And that's important to recognize because these vaccines, the Pfizer Moderna one, are mRNA molecules encapsulated in what's called a liponanoparticle, which is basically fat and cholesterol. And what that does is it simply merges with cell membranes and dumps its load of genetic material into the cells. A virus to naturally get in the cell is limited one at a time to get in through an ACE receptor. But these vaccines have, it looks like, millions or billions of mRNA in them to cause the cell to massively start producing the spike protein inside the cells. And where the vaccine manufacturers will tell you that the vaccines stay at the site of injection because they're telling us, so we should believe them, right? The problem with that is that Moderna had previously published a paper using this same technology, the lipid nanoparticle vaccine for influenza. And what was shown in those studies is that the vaccine doesn't stay in the site of the injection. In fact, the lipid nanoparticles and the mRNA are found in the brain, the heart, the bone marrow, the liver, the spleen of the animals that they tested it in. So the only research that's actually published that I'm aware of on what happens when these injected lipid nanoparticle vaccines occur is that they do spread. And what we know is that they spread throughout the body. And these Pfizer and Moderna haven't provided us with any proof that that's not the case. They've provided no evidence of the deaths or adverse events occurring in people with the vaccines. They have provided no information about several different groups of individuals who received the vaccine. And it's important to understand that these emergency use authorization documents that allow these vaccines to be given are not evidence that the vaccines are safe and effective. That's very clearly stated in the emergency use authorization documents. This is not an FDA stamp of approval, which has other issues related to it. I mean, in the last couple of years, they've taken twice as many drugs off the market as they've approved. So you can wonder about the quality of some of that evaluation of those drugs. But these EUAs are not a license for these drugs to be marketed or used. It's still experimental. There's still great amounts of data that are missing. Both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines have stipulated that there's no adverse enhancement of the virus with the vaccine. Now, Pfizer got its EUA on the 10th of December and Moderna on the 17th. On the 18th of December, the Osaka physician group study looked at the spike protein of this virus and discovered that, in fact, there is an antibody-enhanced infectivity as a result of antibodies being formed to the spike protein. It forms to also what's called the N-terminal domain, so the spike protein has two areas that antibodies tend to get formed to, the regional binding domain, which is what attaches to the ACE2 receptor, and that would be a good thing if you made an antibody there because it would prevent the virus from attaching. But antibodies are also made to the N-terminal domain of the spike protein, and when that happens, it changes the structure of the spike protein and increases the infectivity of the spike protein. We already know that the spike protein doesn't stick around the cells. We know that the lipid nanoparticle vaccine doesn't stay in the muscles, according to the studies that have been published previously. We know that the lipid nanoparticle can penetrate the brain quite easily, as well as cells. And we know that the spike protein penetrates the brain quite readily from the animal models and causes spongiform encephalopathy, or the same thing as mad cow disease is the same process. We also have been able to watch people on social media have movement disorders, Parkinsonian type tremors and fasciculations or tremors of the tongue. And this is the type of thing that occurs when the brain undergoes changes from prion-like compounds. And one of the things we know about the spike protein is that it has a prion-like region right inside the spike protein itself. So the mRNAs are saying, please, code for the spike protein, code for the PRRA, code for the HIV pseudovirus glycoprotein 120, and code for the prion-like region. So it's really another gain of function that we've provided. And frankly, on the far extreme of what runs through my brain as a research scientist is the question about whether the vaccines are not, in fact, SARS-CoV-3. Because if you track the outbreak of the new variants, they follow on the heels of these vaccine schedules. The best argument against that was provided to me by somebody who said, well, wait a minute, Dr. Fleming, the new SARS-CoV-2 variant that occurred in the UK popped up in September. And my counter to that is, okay, I guess I'd like to see that, because as virulent as it is and how rapidly it's spreading through society, my response would be, well, if it popped up in September, why didn't it spread throughout the UK society then? Why did it pop up in December and spread throughout the UK as rapidly as it did and spread to the US? So to say that it was there in September and it's the same virus, but it didn't spread wildly, but now in December it does, indicates that something intervened in that time sequence, and the time sequence coincides with the sequence of these vaccines. As a research scientist, I would like to think that there was a good reason for that actually happening. I'd like to think that they were either investigating it because they were concerned about the possibility of something happening, or the possibility of perhaps somebody else nefariously causing something to happen, and that they had good motives for doing it. That's what I would like to think, and I'll stay with that until I'm forced to think otherwise. However, there comes a point in one's research that you look at something and you go, wow, wait a minute, maybe we need to put the brakes on this. I mean, that's why the gain of function was halted to begin with. When I listened to comments by Barrick and Zhang Li, when they talk about the fact that they could make something more virulent and produce a pandemic, and then that process continues forward, now we get beyond the point of real researchers trying to develop a better understanding and do something good to the potential, you know, just the potential, what is the rationale behind this? Because when you leave the point of saying, I'm doing something good, and you say, and I can make something nastier and cause a pandemic, I think most reasonable people, and this is kind of one of those, you know, in law school, they tell you what's a reasonable person, and I'm not sure we ever settled that in law school, but I would tell you that a reasonable person to me would be my parents or my grandparents. And I can tell you that my parents and my grandparents would say, that's not reasonable. That's harmful. And remember, they have a scientist, physician's son, that they raised and saw after. So they know, at least if by nothing more than watching me as I grew up, since my research career began in seventh grade, that I am geared to doing research. But I'm also, and I guess this is maybe a good time to reflect on some of the things that occasionally come back to memory, which is part of the recruitment process for deciding who was placed in that program was our ability to look at a no-win scenario that they saw and make a decision about who lives and who dies. And I find it difficult to believe that we were the only ones who were put through those tasks of making those decisions. And that raises just in me a level of question and doubt and concern that you're not supposed to, you as the general public are not supposed to have to run through your mind. That's supposed to be something that ran through our minds as a result of being part of this process.
That's just part of an interview. We want to thank Alex Newman, a multi-award-winning international journalist, educator, for conducting the interview. And the whole interview, which is over an hour long, can be watched and listened to on prn.fm and garynall.com. I might mention some new things are happening, things that we predicted. Now, some airlines around the world are not allowing or discouraging people who've been vaccinated to fly because of shedding. Oh, remember? So now the finger's pointing in the opposite direction. Oh, stay away from us, you second-class person, because you're not vaccinated. You're not like us. Yeah. And for those who are not vaccinated, the vaccinated actually could be the vectors, because what we're finding, the vaccine doesn't stay in the shoulder. We were told it did. It goes throughout the body. That's why we're seeing the strokes. And the numbers are astronomical. Tomorrow, I'll give you the numbers. You'll hear a scientist tomorrow, again, an MD, PhD, state that he is certain that there's about 50,000 dead now. And the latest figures show officially 6,000 dead Americans, 6,000, over 300,000 injured. However, and tens of thousands hospitalized with serious life-threatening conditions, they'll have the rest of their life. But everyone in science agrees that the vaccine adverse reporting system, which is voluntary and is reluctant to report on this, is only, according to Harvard, 1 to 2% accurate, meaning it's 98 to 99% not accurate, to as much as 10% being extremely liberal on that. So even if you took that you have to multiply 6 times 9, now you see that you're up to more people have died from the vaccine than all American war casualties in the Vietnam War. There are 2 casualties. I'll give you those casualty figures tomorrow. And if we keep this up, we will surpass many other wars where Americans died. And yet there seems to be no irony on this. Also today, the health services of Great Britain, which is similar to our CDC, has announced now all hospitals have to report 2 different figures. Ah, remember I told you this? Now they have to report cases that are sick and cases that are just positive. Separate them. Well, hold on a second. I challenged the New York Times repeatedly that you were making every single positive case, which is a positive negative, a case, meaning they were sick, they carried the disease, wasn't true. I said you should have 2 numbers, one that are independent studies showing people are COVID positive but healthy versus someone who is sick. They lumped them together to try to gain the system. Now they're recognizing that in Great Britain and reversing the policy. Once again, we were right. The critics were wrong. And in this case, they could have been deadly wrong. Now we're going to go to an interview. And getting them right up here in from Israel. And this is going to be one where we're going to take a look at the New York Times. But specifically, I want him to address some of the things that we're seeing that I'm very concerned about and want to get this on the record. This is Ashley Ringsberg, R-I-N-D-S-B-E-R-G. He's in Israel. He is originally from South Africa. He's an award-winning journalist, essayist, and investigative journalist. And he's written for the Los Angeles Review of Books, Huffington Post, Times of Israel, etc. And he is the author of a new book called The Gray Lady Winked, How the New York Times Misreporting, Distortions, Fabrications, Radically Altered History. Now to our interview. Give us some insights into the 1619 Project.
Yeah, well, you're 100% correct, and it's a very grim reality. And, you know, you mentioned China's economic war on Australia, because one of the few people that dared to question the Chinese orthodoxy, the Chinese propaganda about the origins of COVID-19 was the Prime Minister of Australia, Scott Morrison. This was early. This was last year in around April 2020. And as a result, just as you mentioned, there was outright economic warfare, which meant tariffs on most important exports from Australia to China, included wine, barley, and other very important commodities. And what you see from the New York Times, among other outlets, was that they didn't cover it almost at all. And if you look still today, which I recently did some research on into this topic, which Australia managed to fight back. It was a very difficult situation for Australia, which depends on those exports to China. But they have managed to fight back, and they have managed to find other solutions. And that also was not covered, because if you're covering a story that shows, wait a second, this relatively small nation, island nation, managed to actually take on China and succeed, that's not a good look for China's power. And the Times didn't cover it. Very few other mainstream American outlets covered it as well. And, you know, the question is, what can we believe from the New York Times? I think in general, we do need to question, be healthfully skeptical of all media, and to ask those questions: where is the sourcing? Why did they report this? And most importantly of all, why did they not report on other things, and just those many topics that you have mentioned, Gary, regarding treatments for COVID-19? Why were they not covered? Why were they not explored? Why are there scientists that have been respected for decades that have suddenly been disappeared effectively from the media? Those are questions that are not being raised in the media, and we need to ask why. And at the same time, we need to look at something like the 1619 Project, which has been the focus of so much New York Times coverage. They cover their own coverage about the 1619 Project. They do a podcast and then write an article about it, and then do a web series about the article that they wrote the podcast about. And it's this kind of echo chamber of ideas around this core notion that the 1619 Project is promulgating, and that is that America was built and rooted in slavery, that it is in essence still today some manifestation of a slave society, rather than what we know to be the truth, which is that America was founded, and the Revolutionary War was fought to preserve liberty. They're turning that history on its head to say that it was actually the Revolutionary War was fought to preserve slavery in the colonies, and that America is rooted in slavery and founded on the institution of slavery. And when this actually came out in the media and it started to receive criticism, one of the most telling responses came not from the various historians, of which there were many. And we're talking about historians from very prestigious universities with long track records of doing historical research into these topics, coming out and saying these fundamental facts are false. But the one that really stood out for me was a professor at Northwestern University, a woman named Leslie Harris. She's a professor of African American history and slavery, who was contacted by the New York Times to be used as a fact checker for some of the core claims. And the one very fundamental claim that she was used to fact check was the claim that the Revolutionary War was fought to preserve slavery. And she told them there was absolutely no interpretation, no matter how wide a berth you wanted to give to that notion, it just could not be supported. It was absolutely false. And in fact, if anything, the opposite was true, that the Revolutionary War damaged the institution of slavery in the colonies, if anything. And despite her saying this, she reported to Politico that the Times completely ignored her and reported that the American War, Revolutionary War, was fought to preserve slavery anyway. And what you see from that is that they were absolutely not interested in pursuing the truth. This was their own expert, someone they had come to. They had selected her as an expert, and they ignored her findings, ignored her advice, because the narrative was more important than the truth. And that, to me, is the core notion here, is that when anybody, but especially a journalistic organization, a media organization, puts a narrative before the truth, you have a very, very bad situation. And one, again, that I'm not sure you can come back from. I don't know how you change the ethos within that organization or do some sort of reform. I don't know how that's possible when the priority has become promulgating a narrative such as that being promulgated by the 1619 Project in favor of just bringing us the facts. And that's not to say that American society is a perfect society where race or any other factor is concerned, race, economics, or anything else. It is absolutely not perfect. It's far from it. But that is also not to say that the country is a manifestation of a slavocracy, that it is still some sort of slave society, just with sort of a diluted version of it. And that's exactly what the New York Times is now putting out into the world in a very aggressive manner, and in a way that's really targeting children and through education. It's targeting the culture. They're trying to influence, meaning they are pursuing an agenda. And that's, again, one of those telltale signs that something is deeply wrong, is when you clearly see that they are trying to exert influence rather than just presenting the facts. Those are two very, very different notions of what journalism is and what it's supposed to do. Influence or advancing an agenda versus gathering the facts and presenting them in a quote-unquote gray way, which is why the New York Times have been called the gray lady for so long, because its stated mission, whether or not this was ever true, is very much up for debate. But the stated mission by the founder of the newspaper as we know it today, a man named Adolf Ox, was to present the facts in a very neutral tone, in a very sober-minded way. And clearly they have drifted very far from that mission today. And with them, so has the rest of the media. And that's a very important point, which is that the New York Times is the flagship of the American media. They set the tone, they set the agenda, and their coverage really matters, not just to the readers of the New York Times itself, but to all the other editors and all the other reporters at hundreds of other media organizations across the country and around the world as well. And they have an impact, and that's what we're seeing today on so many stories, such as the 1619 Project, such as woke ideology, lab leak and COVID, and the various omissions on the pandemic that they have chosen not to cover, things like these treatments, these effective and cost-effective treatments that could have been used, which really never got to see light of day. So these are the kinds of questions people really need to ask and to go hunt down those facts. We can't be in this sort of lean back posture anymore, as we were once with Walter Cronkite giving us the news, and we could say, well, this guy is fairly trustworthy, we'll just accept it and turn off the news when he's done with his broadcast. That's no longer the case. We need to lean forward, to go out, look for the facts. When you hear something that doesn't sit right with you, I tell people, go hunt down those facts, go ask those questions, don't be afraid. Because if we are afraid, then we're gonna lose, we've already been defeated. We have to take the risk to be quote unquote demonized by legacy media, by the Wikipedia gatekeepers, that they're gonna edit our pages and our posts to make us look this way or that way. And you know what, if that's the price we have to pay, then that's the price we have to pay, because the truth is more important.
Thank you, Ashley, for that. It concerns me because I've been a teacher for over 45 years in the academic systems in New York, College of New Rochelle, Pratt Institute, the School of Visual Arts and other places. And never have I seen a professor, adjunct or full professor or tenure professor, feel threatened by walking into a class out of fear that they will in some way say something or use a wrong pronoun that will cause the students to feel as if their entire existence is no longer relevant and therefore be brought up on charges. But today we see exactly that, and it's infiltrating all of our educational curriculums from grammar school through college. Mark Crispin Miller, a person I have a great deal of respect for. Do you know, have you ever heard of Mark Crispin Miller, professor?
Yes, I have. He wrote the foreword to my book, The Great Leader Wing. Very generously, yes.
He's one of those people who are out there fighting. And he's frequently been on this program, and he's an excellent example. Corporations now conduct woke trainings for employees, and in some cases it is mandated only for whites. And it has also become the overriding ideology behind the cancel culture. It started with a long essay in the New York Times, journalist Nicola Hannah Jones. I also want to note that this Times journalist, Hannah Jones, received the Pulitzer Prize last year for her 1619 project, which you just articulated some of the things that are wrong with it. And the New York University School of Journalism named it one of the 10 greatest works of journalism during the past decade. So, Ashley, you've laid out what's over and the overarching issue, what's wrong with the 1619 Project, and the basic argument. Tell us more, if you can, about Hannah Jones and what do you believe her ultimate goal and intention is, knowing that unless she stated it, it is subjective, we're guessing. And then finally, tell us a bit about how this wokeness that has now infiltrated the New York Times has shaken up much of its staff, including firing people simply for having what historically had been a difference of opinion, which could be a point of debate. And as a scientist and a journalist, both, I'm very concerned when science says you cannot debate an issue. In fact, in Canada, if you're a physician and you have any questions that you are raising about using any of the vaccines there, you can lose your license to practice medicine. You cannot ask a question about it. And so since when does a physician feel so threatened? We'll come back in just a moment. I just want to say to our WBA audience, you'll be leaving us in about a minute here to go to the news, but everyone else can stay tuned at prn.fm. And we'll take the interview up to the top of the show. In the world, MD, PhDs, professors, scientists with hundreds of published papers, one has 1,000 published papers, they're going forward and say, I don't care what you say, I don't care what you do to my career, I'm going to tell the people the truth because it's more important than one person's reputation or career, and they're telling the truth. And the New York Times and others will go after these people. They will never interview them. They will never give them an opportunity to debate the issues. That no one is doing in the mainstream media. Would you address this, please?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, with Nicole Hannah Jones, I think she is one player in a much larger system of ideology. And that ideology is one that's using this issue of identity politics, of race, as an instrument of power. To achieve what end, I don't know exactly what it is. I think in the New York Times' case, it's a great lever for it to advance its own corporate interests because it gives them a wedge to drive between certain members of society. And again, with the New York Times, we have to remember that they no longer have a large subscriber base like they once did. It used to be that if you lived in New York City, you could choose between one of three or four newspapers, and your choice would likely be the New York Times, and you would pay them for that, for the information they deliver. Today, something like 2% of an average newspaper's readership is actually paying them subscription fee. And what that means is that it ends up skewing their coverage to cater to that 2%. That's the diehard, the hardcore 2%. And that's exactly, I think, what's going on on an institutional level with the New York Times. Nicole Hannah-Jones herself, whether or not she really believes in this stuff, it's hard to say. She's been reporting on racial issues for a long, long time, for close to 10 years now, or maybe even more, including what she calls school segregation. Her early work focused on the notion that, in her opinion, American schools were still racially segregated. She was trying to make the case that it was fairly deliberate, that there was some mechanism out there that was trying to keep white kids and black kids in separate schools. And again, there's this kind of overtone when you think about a story like that of something that feels a little bit like a conspiracy, but the Times would never call it that. The Times would never say, wait a second, if you're going to make a claim that there are these terrible, nefarious forces trying to keep white kids and black kids from learning together, you're going to have to tell us who they are and you're going to have to prove it. But they never held Nicole Hannah-Jones to that standard. It was always just met with a lot of applause when she published this very big New York Times Magazine story about her own daughter, putting her own daughter in what she called a segregated school when it came time to put her child into the school system. She just was instantly celebrated. Nobody was asking the hard questions about saying, you know, show us the data, show us the causes, show us how this is actually happening. No, it wasn't that. It was just, here's the prize. Here's your Peabody Prize. Later on, after that, a National Magazine Award, and then finally her Pulitzer. And once you get that Pulitzer, it is the stamp of approval that what you have reported is the gospel truth. But when we go back and look at the Pulitzers and see how problematic that prize is, that Walter Duranty, the man who covered up the Ukraine famine, was awarded a Pulitzer for that reporting, not for other reporting, it was for reporting that denied the Ukraine famine. Two of the New York Times reporters who were working out of the Berlin office where Guido Anderis, the Berlin bureau chief I'd mentioned, one of whom was the reporter responsible for the headline calling the Nazi Olympics the greatest sporting event of all time, those two also won Pulitzer Prizes. The New York Times science reporter who covered up the fact that there was radiation poisoning as a result of the atomic bomb dropped in Japan, and he did so because the New York Times had a deal with the Department of War that the New York Times would get access to the bomb, to reporting on the bomb, in exchange for their sympathetic reporting on topics like radiation poisoning. That man also received a Pulitzer. We have this long list of Pulitzer recipients who actively promulgated false narratives. And this is the system. This is the mechanism. It's a social system. It's like an ecosystem where you get the magazine story, you get the award, you get the Pulitzer, you get the big appearance on Oprah. And no matter how problematic the reporting was, it's instantly given this kind of glaze of credibility, this kind of lacquer of truth, where in reality, it's anything but. And again, these are the kinds of structures that we have to contend with.
Okay, we're out of time. I want to thank him for being on from Israel. He will be back. There's more to discuss. And we will be having people on to discuss the New York Times in greater depth, especially their support for 5G and other errors they've made, current errors, by attacking the developers of hydroxychloroquine and the use of it at clinical level, where millions of people are using hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin in India, and their death rate is plummeting, and yet none of this is being covered favorably by the New York Times. Remember, our voices only matter if you share them. So might I suggest that you take last week's article and share it, and tell people, download the program, share the program. I have a really powerful program. I have two commentaries I've written. In fact, I was counseling all day yesterday. I counseled about 20 people for about 12 hours. That's why my voice is a little raspy today. But back tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.